Tina Brown joins us on this day before Thanksgiving. She comes to us regularly as the editor of Newsweek and the Daily Beast with reading recommendations that we talk about. We call it word of mouth. We'll hear about some things we can read over this long holiday weekend. Hi, Tina.
Good morning, Steve. How are you?
I'm doing great. Thank you very much. Happy Thanksgiving to you.
And to you.
And we're going to be talking about newspaper columnists here, and we're going to talk about some really interesting columns, present and past. And let's begin with the present and Wall Street Journal columnist Peggy Noonan, whose column here is headlined, "A Caveman Won't Beat a Salesman." What does she mean?
Well, what is great about Peggy Noonan is she has a brilliant way of being able to pivot off a conversational point of something that she's heard and then work it out into an interesting and different kind of denouement. And she starts by coming off the Steve Jobs book by Walter Isaacson, where she notes that Steve makes a very interesting comment about why a decline happens at great companies. And he says the company does a great job, innovates, and becomes a monopoly or close to it in some field, and then the quality of the product becomes less important. And he says that, you know, salesmen take over and the actual quality of the product kind of gets marginalized. Mm-hmm. That's where the rot set in. And then he goes on to discuss the president, and he talks about how the president is very smart, but he kept explaining to us reasons why things can't get done. And Peggy really pivots off of that and says, you know, Obama, in her mind, was also a salesman who really didn't understand, in a sense, the quality of the product, in which case, you know, America. And she goes even further, and she talks about how Herman Cain is also, therefore, you know, an embarrassment to America, because Herman Cain also doesn't kind of respect the product, in this case, politics. The democracy, the way that, you know, the body politic runs, when he just simply cannot answer a question about what he feels about what the president did in Libya. And literally, as she writes, you know, kind of gropes for his soundbite and can't find it. And that's why he's brain-freezed. And she says that this disrespect for the democratic process, this misunderstanding of what politics is, in a sense, and what running for office means, does an enormous disservice to the GOP, because it makes people feel that the GOP runners are, in fact, you know, disrespectful of the process, are, in fact, you know, not able to do it intellectually and have no ability to govern.
She starts by criticizing President Obama, but ends up criticizing her own party. She says Republicans are skeptical of government. They're right to be skeptical of excessive power of government, but that their candidates and a lot of voters have ended up cheering the notion that you don't even need to know what you're doing.
Exactly right. I think it's a terrific piece. And, it, you know, you'd never expect she would get there from the way she starts. But very interesting point of view. And, of course, you know, Cain did it again when he said, you know, that he thought the Taliban might take over in Libya. I mean, you know, this guy, it seems, doesn't even read the newspapers.
So let's move on to another column here. This is by New York Times columnist David Brooks. And he is taking a second look at the way we have perceived the Penn State scandal, the arrest of a former assistant coach on sexual abuse charges and the related incidents.
Yes, well, he talks very, very interestingly, I think, about this whole case that's so fascinated people. He says, you know, the vanity is the outraged reaction of a zillion commentators over the past week whose indignation is based on the assumption that had they been in Paterno's shoes or McQueary's shoes, that they would have behaved better. And he goes on to argue that actually, unfortunately, the evidence of history and of society is that that doesn't happen, of course, most classically during the Holocaust. But he says some people can't process the horror in front of them. Some people suffer from what psychologists call normalcy bias. When they find themselves in an unsettling circumstance, they shut down and they just pretend that everything is normal, which, of course, you know, one sees a great deal. But he also says that people suffer from motivated blindness when they don't see what's not in their interest to see. And, of course, that has been shown tremendously in some of the fallout for this Paterno case.
You mentioned McQueary. Of course, you're talking about Mike McQueary, the assistant coach who discovered, allegedly, Jerry Sandusky abusing a child inside the Penn State locker room and either did nothing or did not do enough, depending on whose account you believe. This is the person, classically, that people say, well, if I was there, of course I would have stopped it.
Absolutely
Brooks
right.
says, don't be so sure of yourself.
That's right. He says not necessarily so. I mean, they could have suffered from either the normalcy bias that he writes about or motivated blindness. And he also then talks about the bystander effect. And he says, so many people do nothing while witnessing ongoing crimes that psychologists have given it that name, the bystander effect. The more people are around to witness the crime, the less likely, in fact, they are to intervene.
You know, there's a line in this column, people are really good at self-deception. And your next recommended reading here is a book full of columnists who try to get us to take a second and clearer look at things.
Yes, I love this book. It's called Deadline Artist, America's Greatest Newspaper Columns, edited by John Avalon, Jesse Angelo, and Errol Lewis. And, you know, for a sort of newspaper magazine, an online junkie like myself, to read these collected columns that they've taken, you know, over many, many years, you know, dividing them into sections of humor and war and sports, hard times, crime. There's some wonderful bylines in here that one just has forgotten, like Damon Runyon, some of the great columns of Mike Royko, of Pete Hamill, of the wonderful, wonderful Jimmy Breslin. And they say in the introduction that the columnist speaks in a voice readers understand, their own but just a bit better, a voice that comforts and confronts. A great column is both a witness and a work of art, helping people understand the world around them and making them feel a little less alone. And I think that's absolutely right. I mean, I think that the best of these columns are really telling a little story. They're about reporting. They're about really telling, you know, human detail that's filled a notebook. And Avalon and his co-writers make the point that, you know, in the era of the kind of the fast sort of internet kind of punditry, in a sense, the art of the reported column, where the writer actually goes out and tells a little vivid story that adds kind of moral dimension to the way we look at the world, is becoming somewhat marginalized. And this is a way for us to look at these kind of writings and say, you know, there's something here to compete with. There's something here we can really revive in our approach to newspaper columns and indeed internet columns.
We should mention John Avalon is a guy who works for you at the Daily Beast.
Indeed he does.
You, of course, have hired and perhaps fired a few columnists over the years at different publications. What quality of mind or what quality of writing do you see that makes a columnist last and stick in people's minds?
I think it's really about how they think and their ability to empathize in a unique and interpretive way, in a sense, with both their readers and the culture. You know, you really want to feel that the writer is both absolutely in tune with what's happening in the culture, but also has a kind of counterintuitive response to it that goes against the grain, but at the same time is something that you can really, really identify with. And I think Pete Hamill is one of those great columnists, actually. He wrote incredible material during 9/11, covering in absolutely vivid detail from the point of view of his own trek through the streets of Manhattan. He said, "I start running toward Broadway through dust 2 inches deep. Park Row is white. City Hall Park is white. Sheets of paper are scattered everywhere. Orders for stocks, way bills, purchase orders, the pulverized confetti of capitalism." And I thought that was a brilliant way of describing it. And he wrote that on a dime. I mean, he was writing that in the mayhem of that day. That's what one has to remember. These columns were written in the mayhem of the day when there was been no time to look what other people were writing or think about it or marinate on it. It was simply what he wrote with pure, pure vision and eyes and heart. And it reads that way to this day.
Tina, it's always a pleasure talking with you.
Thank you.
Word of mouth from Tina Brown, editor of Newsweek and The Daily Beast.